Hey Arizona, welcome to another episode of Copper Talk. I'm your host, Matt Morales, and with me as always,
Marilyn Purvis, and with us as always,
it's Sam Richard. Hello everybody.
And there's an empty seat across the table.
Thankfully.
Not for long though.
No, Barrett's just too busy for this episode.
The never effervescent Barrett Marcy.
Oh. Never vescent?
The never-vescent.
Yeah, the never-vescent.
Anyway, back to the show. So this week, major focus is the pace at the legislature. Everything is going very quickly. We're all feeling the stress and pressure. And everybody is talking about the budget. That is the driving force behind the rush. So, Sam, you've been down there with me. What are your thoughts about how quickly this is moving and what's been going on?
Yeah, so there was a 90-minute joint appropriations hearing that was very rushed. So rushed, in fact, that the minority caucus had their own JLBC presentation the following day. So that's interesting that we only had time to hear from the OSPB. And as you'll remember from previous episodes when we had Professor Dennis Hoffman on, that the OSPB projections are oftentimes very different than the JLBC projections. And the JLBC is designed to be a little bit more independent. And lo and behold, their projections tended to be a tad bit more negative to the tune of, $200 to $300 million.
So just a little bit.
Just a little tad.
And then, yes, the Senate Democrats complaining about the race to the finish. Senate Democrats motioned just the other day to reintroduce budget subcommittees so they may discuss matters relevant to the state tax dollars in a more open and transparent way. And Democrats weren't the only people complaining. There were a few members in that 90-minute rushed hearing with the OSPB saying, we only get one chance at this. Let us ask some questions.
Right.
So, Sam, though something weird happened this week in that the House, despite the rumors flying about the rush, we didn't first read bills?
Yes, yeah. So you mentioned the pace, and there definitely is a quick pace in some corners of the Capitol, but there were no bills assigned to committee.
Wait a second. Hold on. I'm going to interject for a second as the conservative voice in the room. It's not a one-shot thing. You know that the OSPB office will take questions from legislators, year-round practically. So to come out as and say that it's, oh my God, we don't get to actually hear an answer, is really, really incorrect and kind of grandstanding on their part, because anybody, including citizens of the state of Arizona, can ask OSPB questions anytime, and they're really good. I remember when Arnold was there, every question got answered.
Sure, but in the budget presentation that traditionally speaking lasts hours and hours and hours.
And is held in a public forum.
This is the first time that it's changed, that the format has changed. And the answer to that question that wasn't just coming from the Democrats, it was coming from some of the Republicans, was, we'll get to it. And given that it is moving as quickly, or it is rumored, the session is rumored to be moving as quickly as it can, I don't know if the members are thinking, I have enough time to ask that question, right? So you see this as your only opportunity, and it's cut short.
I think that's naive, to think that it's your only opportunity.
It may be, but they're worried.
Maybe that's why we were talking about term limits? Maybe you have to learn how the process goes?
Well, that's a whole other copper talk. So Sam, we don't first read bills. Now what?
Yeah, it's very interesting. I mean, obviously in many corners of the Capitol, and we're hearing from the ninth floor as well as Senate President Biggs, that this is going to be another swift session. But we didn't first read bills at least one day this week in the House, and there's upwards of 500 bills that have been introduced. So if you don't assign those bills to committee, then we're kind of gumming up the process here. So it's going to be fairly difficult to be out by Easter again if we haven't even first read a majority of the bills that have been introduced.
Yeah, these guys are blowing our predictions right out of the water.
I know. I want my candy bar from that.
Well, how many more bills do we have this year than last year?
There's already over 800. As of recording this episode, there are 800 that are in the system.
Well, that's on track. That's on track. It's usually about 1,000. And what, 300 of those will end up being signed into law?
Yeah, there were 324 last session.
So it's fairly similar, which means, again, you're feeling such rush. And even in this first week, we are hearing bills. This last week, we heard a lot of them. And then this week, we have stacked committees again. So it's not just the naivety or the fear that we're moving too quickly. It is moving very quickly. Mm-hmm. So we're looking at the landscape here. Bills being heard earlier than usual. It's all the majority's bills who happen to be the ones who you need the votes for to push this rumored very fast budget. So I don't think it's grandstanding, Matt. I think that they're legitimately concerned that there is this process happening behind the scenes that they're not involved with, and they're mad.
Marilyn, if they take all the time in the world that they need, how long do you think we'll be here? With 1,000 bills.
However long it takes. However long it takes, Matt. I am of the persuasion...
January 2017.
Fine. I'm here.
By statute, you stop getting your per diem at day 130 or 135. So I'd say that
I imagine how fast after that they'll be wanting to go home.
Maybe we can change it to year-round session. I don't know. Another Copper Talk. Time for another Copper Talk. Anyway, today on this episode of Copper Talk, we have a few really awesome items for you, Matt. The first
one
is...
We really do. Yeah. So, returning guest hosts, Mike Liberti, our senior legal analyst, get to sit down and take over the studio and interview newly minted Justice Clint Bolick.
Yes. And fun fact, it's a long O, Justice Bolick.
Yeah. We were corrected. we poke fun at Mike for being our return guest, and we love him to have him on the show, but he is the senior legal counsel to Governor Ducey. And we're very
that's
very
his
thankful.
Real title.
His real job.
His day job. Our listeners can't hear the air quotes that I'm making when I call him our senior legal analyst. Yes. Can I do that? Is there a way to project that across the microphone?
I don't know. Maybe tap or click.
Senior legal analyst. He's an amazing guy. And the thing was, is that for those of us sitting in the studio right now, we were watching in awe as the two of them sat together because they were referencing cases from God knows when.
Right.
Well,
if you ever once thought you knew anything about the legal system, sit next to the two of them or just wait till after the break and listen to these two talk about constitutional law, you'll realize how little you know.
Right.
Well, and then after that, Sam introduces the Copper Talk Book Club.
Yes, I'm very excited. I sat down with Professor Philip Vandermeer, who wrote a biography on Burton Barr that is absolutely fascinating, and I suggest you pick it up. We have a link to purchase that book in the show notes, and we'll have other conversations with authors coming in the future. We have a book that was released on Jack Feaster and some other great authors coming on the show. So we have to come up with a cool sound effect, but you know, maybe something like pages turning.
Sam takes his first shot at being a folly artist.
Yes, I think it's just it is definitely folly. It's not a folly artist. I have nothing but folly.
Well, with that, I'm Marilyn.
And I'm Matt.
And I'm Sam.
And right after a short break, Baird will be coming back in the studio to introduce two great men in Arizona politics, Mike Liberti and Justice Clint Bolick.
This is Jim Small, editor of Arizona News Service. If you want to know the news before it happens and get the real story behind the story, read the Yellow Sheet Report today. To subscribe, visit yellowsheetreport.com.
Welcome back, Copper Talk listeners. I am your host, Barrett Marson, and today we have a unique segment. I'm very excited to introduce our two guests. We have with us for the first time Justice Clint Bolick from the newly minted justice from the Arizona Supreme Court. Welcome to the show. And he is going to be interviewed by the person who interviewed him for his current job, the governor's chief counsel and head lawyer and chief muckety muck as well, Mike Liberti. So, gentlemen, welcome to the show. I'm really excited to hear the type of questions that you, Mike, are going to ask the new justice.
Well, thank you, Barrett. I want to make sure all your listeners know that I offered a deal to Justice Bolick. I would show him my questions before the interview if he would show me his before my next oral argument.
Well, and you know, Mike, transparency is the order of the day, so that would only be fair.
Okay, well, thanks, Justice Bolick. Just a little bit about yourself. You were born in Elizabeth, New Jersey. And you went to college at Drew University. Is that in New Jersey as
well? It is.
And law school at UC Davis. What brought you to California for law school?
The absence of snow was the most the biggest part, which also helped bring us to Arizona ultimately, is my wife Shauna went to Syracuse and grew up in Pittsburgh. We have developed a permanent allergy to snow, and so that living in the land of sunshine is very hospitable to us.
Well, you sound like my dad, but I was wondering if you went to Davis because of its connection with the famous affirmative action case, University of California Regents versus Bakke.
I actually did not. That was going on the year that I was choosing law schools, but I think I was probably the only student in my law school that supported Alan Bakke's position in that case.
And for listeners who may not know, that was the Supreme Court case from the late 1970s that ended racial quotas for professional school admissions.
That's right.
Now, Justice Bullock, you've worked at several public interest law firms over your career. What kind of work does a public interest firm undertake?
Well, it really depends on the firm. You've got firms that do environmental work or civil rights work. The groups that I worked with, starting from Mountain States Legal Foundation and the Institute for Justice of the Goldwater Institute, most recently focused on constitutional litigation and specifically areas such as free speech, private property rights, defending school choice programs, and at Goldwater, focusing on taxpayer rights under the state constitution, public records, and things of that nature.
I think it's fair to say that you're a prolific writer. Would you agree with that?
Yes.
And now that you're on the court, you have the royalties of all these books that could keep you...
Well, I mostly... I that would be awesome if it were true. Unfortunately, most of my writing was for nonprofit organizations, and my books were mostly, with a couple of exceptions, published by nonprofits, no royalties.
Okay. One of your many books is David's Hammer, which some characterize is your case for an activist judiciary. What was the central thesis of David's Hammer?
Basically, that the framers of the United States Constitution intended the judiciary to be the branch of government that would keep the other two branches of government to their constitutional powers. And that when the judiciary performs that function, it is being activist, but it is being appropriately activist. And that in that regard, we need courts to be even more active because the powers of government are expanding at a very, very quick rate, not just the executive and the legislative branches, but the unelected branches, the administrative agencies, the zoning commissions, and on, that exercise sweeping powers but often don't have democratic accountability.
Now, since your appointment, some in conservative circles and others in other circles of the bar have raised this as an issue, that the governor's appointed an activist judge. How do you respond to that charge?
Well, that, of course, will remain to be seen, and activism is in the eye of the beholder. For many people, activism simply means decisions with which they disagree, and certainly in that regard, probably every judge is at some times an activist judge. But I took an oath to uphold the U.S. Constitution and the Arizona Constitution. Those constitutions contain rights that are absolutely essential, and they both contain limits on government power. And if enforcing the Constitution equates to being an activist judge, then I suspect I'll be guilty as charged.
One of your most famous, or some would characterize infamous, cases involved a very expensive parking garage conducted by the city of Phoenix up near Desert Ridge in the City North development. Now, the court ruled in your favor that development project violated the gift clause. What is the gift clause?
Well, the gift clause is something that a lot of people would not be familiar with. It is a provision of our state constitution, and similar provisions exist in a few dozen state constitutions around the country that prohibit gifts of public funds to private individuals, associations, or corporations. Basically, it was intended to prohibit giveaways of public funds. And the City North case, which was decided by the Arizona Supreme Court, essentially said, listen, you cannot, and in this case, the city of Phoenix was trying to give $100 million to a Chicago developer to build a shopping mall, the City North shopping mall. And the court said that because the developer was not giving back an equivalent amount of benefits, direct benefits to the city, that it was an improper subsidy.
Lots of real estate lawyers and developers cursed your name for this case.
Lots of lobbyists.
They say that the case makes it harder for cities to engage in economic development. Is there a way to set them at ease now that you're on the Supreme Court?
Well, certainly I will, as a justice, take every case according to the facts and the law in that case. I have to check my policy preferences at the door of the courthouse. Where I think their concern lies is with the gift clause of the Constitution and other provisions of the Constitution, particularly the progressive era Constitution that we have here in Arizona. A number of provisions were designed to prevent the alliance of government and corporations that were adverse to the interests of the public. So, you know, if those provisions are brought to bear, I certainly would pursuant to my oath, vigorously enforce them.
Now that you're on the court, do you think that there's reason to perhaps clarify the City North case? What conduct of cities and towns would be permissible under the gift clause?
Well, I think that decision was really an outstanding decision, not just because of the outcome, but because of the clarity of that decision. And Mike, I think that cities and other governmental entities have worked very, very hard to abide by that decision. So I actually think that that's really a model of the type of judicial clarity to which I would aspire. If there are instances where that decision needs clarification, I certainly would be interested in doing so.
Well, let's talk about the nuts and bolts of judicial decision-making for a minute. Let's assume you just heard a case argument, and you've made a decision on how it should go. You get back to conference with the four other justices, but none of them agree with you. What does Justice Bullock do at this point?
What I would do, and of course you've clerked over there, so you know how this takes place. But if I felt strongly about my position, then I would write a dissenting opinion. I think that the Arizona Supreme Court in recent years has been known for its unanimity, although there have been a number of cases in which there have been dissenting opinions. What I would try to do is to articulate my position and seek out, basically send out the message that that there is some disagreement on the court, and perhaps future cases would be appropriate to discuss those differences. The one thing I hope never to do is to be uncollegial, if there is such a word. I think that you can disagree while always respecting your colleagues. That's not always been the case on the Arizona Supreme Court. It's not certainly not always been the case on the United States Supreme Court. I think that unanimity is not necessary, but collegiality is.
There are some cases, even at the Supreme Court level, where lawyers are less than great. I'm sure you've experienced lawyers on the other side who, you know, maybe miss important cases. They're not great writers. They miss facts in the record. when you have a case where a lawyer fails to make the strongest argument or perhaps misses key parts of the factual record, what will you do? Do you think that, the poor lawyering should penalize the party, or would you see it as your job to try and remedy that situation?
Well, it really depends on the situation. We have the resources at the court to make sure that regardless of the quality of advocacy, that anything that appropriately can be considered by the court in terms of cases that may have been missed or parts of the record, that we can be made aware of them. There are instances, however, where the poor quality of lawyering could result in waiving a particular argument. For example, if an argument wasn't raised in the courts below. And sometimes you can consider those arguments, but sometimes you can't. And in those instances, I think that the best the court can do is to say, this may have been different in a different case, and to basically send, again, a signal to the bar that they've got to be really careful. One of those things, by the way, is something that I really hope to remedy, and that is many times lawyers do not raise arguments under the Arizona Constitution. They simply raise them under the U.S. Constitution.
And I have to say, as being a participant in this for many years now, that is subject of quite a bit of debate. Former Chief Justice Feldman wrote a law review article about it in the 80s. My boss, former Chief Justice McGregor, wrote a law review article about it, and folks talk about it quite a bit. What role should the Arizona Constitution and its Declaration of Rights play when deciding issues like search and seizure or privacy or free speech? What's your approach to that?
My approach is that the Arizona Constitution ought to always be raised, because even if the provisions of the Arizona and the U.S. Constitution are identical, we are free to go above and beyond the interpretation of the U.S. Constitution. We can't go below it, but we can go above it. And of course, there are many provisions that appear in the Arizona Constitution that don't appear in the U.S. Constitution. So one of my roles in the community will be to encourage lawyers always to consider the Arizona Constitution and to make whatever arguments are available, so that it's not an afterthought, it's a forethought.
Well, how would you decide whether to depart from U.S. Supreme Court and federal court interpretations of, let's say, free speech, the right to privacy, depart from those rules and go towards a more expansive interpretation of the analogous Arizona right?
Well, Mike, that is an area where I really do hope to contribute to the development of Arizona jurisprudence, because right now there are no rules for when that independent interpretation should take place or how it should take place. And I think that it is very important to develop those rules. Personally, I would look at the history of the Arizona Constitution and what the law was when the Arizona Constitution took place. It may be that federal law has evolved since that time, but that doesn't necessarily mean that Arizona law has evolved or should follow in lockstep. So I plan to put a great deal of personal effort into identifying the objective rules that ought to apply, and encouraging the court to make it clear so that lawyers can effectively bring those kinds of arguments our court.
What would you make of the fact that the Arizona's Declaration of Rights, certain rights have different wording than the U.S. Constitution? For example, the free speech right, or even Arizona's Constitution has a specific right to privacy, which doesn't exist in the federal constitution.
See, in those instances, and as a litigator, I had opportunity to litigate the free speech clause of the Arizona Constitution, and it certainly, and our court has said it's broader. It hasn't said how it's broader. So how that will proceed will depend on the cases that are brought to the court, and we'll look at the history and more importantly, we'll look at the text. And if the text is clear, then the decisions ought to be relatively simple. But as you know, that's rarely rarely the case.
That is the truth, Justice. So you were installed on Monday. It was your first day?
Yes.
Monday. And then you had oral argument yes. with your four colleagues on Tuesday. How was it? How did it feel sitting on the bench looking towards the lawyers as opposed to being at the podium addressing the court?
Well, first of all, it was nice for the first time to have the cameras in the courtroom recording the argument record the front of my face rather than the back of my head. I was nervous as could be about getting my robe stuck under the rolling wheels of my chair, and I'd get up and fall flat on my face. I avoided that, fortunately. But other than that, it was really a very exciting situation to be able to listen to the lawyers, to ask questions, to hear the great questions that my colleagues asked. It was fantastic. The advocacy juices definitely flow. I'm going to have to get over that over time. But it really, it's just a tremendous honor as well as being a tremendous responsibility to sit up there and to try to figure out what the right answer is.
At Goldwater Institute, you used to work with several young staff attorneys, and now you get to hire law clerks, two of them, usually fresh out of law school. What is the best advice that you could give to young lawyers?
Well, first of all, I consider my mentoring role before and now as a justice one of the most important things that I do. And I really, really love to nurture young lawyers and to really help polish them and send them out into the world. Really, The advice that I would give is to identify what you really want to do in the law and what you're good at. Those two things don't always coincide. And then to gear your law school and the early years of your law career to the intersection of those two things. It may mean, like for me, I was already a good writer and researcher in law school, but my oral advocacy skills really were dismal.
My, how things have changed.
So I focused on moot court. I ignored the advice to do law review, and I worked diligently to try to be able to get clear words out of my mouth. Sometimes that still fails me. And that really is the advice that I think that young people should follow, especially the part about following what you really want to do, because you're going to have 40 years in legal practice. Make it something that your heart and soul is behind.
Well, that's great advice. I have one last question, and this is something that everybody in LD28 wants to know. Will your lovely wife, Shauna Bollock, be running again for the legislature? Or now that you're on the Supreme Court, is that something that's probably not going to happen?
Well, first of all, we have moved to LD22. So if she does make a run at some point, it will be in our new legislative district. And I have to say that my wife has politics in her blood. I am always encouraging her to follow her dreams, just as she encourages me to do that. And so it would not surprise me to one day be introducing my wife as a representative or Senator Bollock.
Well, thank you, Justice Bollock. It was great sitting down with you, and we wish you the best of luck going forward.
Thanks, Mike, and please keep up your excellent work for the governor.
Thank you.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the studio. I am very excited to have with us here Professor Philip Vandermeer, who has recently released a biography on longtime Majority Leader Burton Barr, and it's a fascinating read. You should definitely pick it up. We'll have a link to buy it in the show notes, so look out for that. And welcome to the studio, Professor.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Great. So I want to start off just because this was one of the most fascinating meta questions for me about this book, is that the foreword was written by Alfredo Gutierrez, right? So a longtime minority leader in the Senate wrote the biography for the longtime majority leader in the House. Do you think that when books are written about our current politicians today, that that will ever happen?
I rather doubt it. I think that it is a particular tribute to Burton Barr, but also to Alfredo Gutierrez, that they formed this kind of friendship. I think that they had similar goals. I think they also fit into a particular time in political history, so that the parties, to some extent, overlapped more. I think that that helped. I think that clearly their own personalities were also very important in this. I would also say that Alfredo was, as he described it to me, came to the legislature as a junior person, not familiar with how the legislature worked. He recognized Barr was a master at the process, and he worked with him. And Barr, to his credit, wanted to respond. And of course, ultimately, they became very close friends, so that right. after Barr's retirement, he eventually went to work with Alfredo in this consulting firm they set up.
Wow. What a testament. And maybe when Senator Hobbs is done with her time in the legislature, her and Speaker Gowan could form a consultancy. Well, we know that Burt Barr joined the state legislature in 1964. That was when he was elected, so he was sworn in 65. But tell me a little bit about his time before that. He was a war hero, and he met some characters that ended up being pretty popular in their own way.
Yes, he had a very interesting background. He did not seem destined for success growing up. He had a reasonably good a period of adolescence and high school, but he dropped out of college. He caddied at a Los Angeles country club. He finally came back to school in the mid-30s and started reading world history and paying attention to particularly to World War One. Of course, there were storm clouds on the horizon at this stage. And so Barr joined ROTC, trained in ROTC, and after graduation, entered the Army. And as he came up to receive his orders, the commanding officer there was a lieutenant colonel named Dwight David Eisenhower. And he wound up getting in Eisenhower's company, and he saw Eisenhower's techniques in dealing with people as very helpful. He drew lessons from Eisenhower, saw Eisenhower at various times during the war. Barr himself started with the invasion in North Africa in October of 42 and continued on into Germany at the conclusion of the war. He won two Silver Stars. He was clearly a war hero, right. But very self-deprecating. He said two Congressional Medal of Honor winners were in his company. He said, those guys were heroes. I was just a guy.
Wow.
He played all of that down. But clearly his time in the military was hugely important in shaping how he viewed people. He looked at the camaraderie in the military. He saw the way in which they defined tasks. He saw the way in which people sacrificed. Mm. And he also saw that everyone had a purpose. Everyone could be valuable. And he carried those lessons throughout his legislative life, too.
Yeah. One of my favorite anecdotes of that time period that you share in the book was when he kind of got into a little trouble. So at the time, Lieutenant Colonel Eisenhower yelled at him fairly publicly. When it came time to sit down in the mess for lunch, they said he kind of sat in a different table with a different company. And halfway through lunch or towards the end of lunch, Lieutenant Colonel Eisenhower pulled him aside and said, "What are you doing?" And he got it reamed again because he said, "When I yell at you, that's it. I can look past it. We work through an issue and we move forward." I'm paraphrasing, of course. Yes. And I think that's something that is definitely showed in his legislative leadership, because there are no permanent friends. There are no permanent enemies. You know, somebody who was an ally to him on an issue in one bill or one committee might have been at odds with him on a different bill or a different committee, and he didn't necessarily let those two things bleed into each other. He really allowed each issue to stand on its own merits.
Absolutely. He clearly did not hold a grudge. He rarely got angry, and I think someone said once he couldn't be angry for any longer than he could hold his breath. he also, like really good politicians, he loved people.
Yeah.
He just enjoyed talking to them. And so that sense of personal interest and caring and actually compassion. Terry Goddard mentioned that he thought that Barr was a compassionate person.
Right.
That carried through. People understood this is who Barr was as a real character. It wasn't an act.
Right. So we mentioned it a little bit that there's a different kind of attitude, a different kind of feeling between lawmakers now than maybe was there when Majority Leader Barr was in office. I know that you're a historian, you're a biographer, you don't want to necessarily offer prescriptions, but if Majority Leader Barr were here today, what would he say about the effect of term limits and maybe even other changes to the structure of the legislature?
Well, I think the first thing he would say is that term limits are problematic. He was in office for 22 years when he retired, and clearly, I should say he was a fast study. So he learned really after one term pretty clearly how things were operating. But I think that for most legislators, it takes a little while. The political system is a big system, and actually knowing not just who the legislators are, but the people in the other chamber and people in the administration. And there's so many people to know to be able to figure out how to do things. So that particularly, and not just in the legislature, in the early 80s, when there were some issues that needed to be solved, I think there was a homeless shelter. Somebody was interested in a homeless shelter. Barr made about 3 phone calls, and homeless shelter got set up. Wow. So it's knowing who, what, and how.
Right.
That's important. So I think that's certainly right.
Yeah.
Term limits is part of it. I think that it's probably also true that the money has changed politics. Barr said that when he first campaigned, in 64, he spent $750.
Wow.
By the early 80s, this is up to $50,000 in more contested races, and obviously it's gone way up since then. So state legislatures have changed in a smaller way to the way in which Congress has changed.
Right.
And that's got implications for the relationships.
Good. Well, thank you for all this. This has been a wonderful conversation. Before we close, and again, Philip Vandermeer wrote a book called Burton Barr, Political Leadership and the Transformation of Arizona. A link to purchase it is in our show notes. What is maybe one story, maybe two, if you have them, that were left on the proverbial cutting room floor that you'd like to share with this Capitol community?
Well, I think one of Barr's favorite World War II stories is still illustrative. He was in charge of waterproofing trucks that would be landed for the Italy invasion. And so they had been testing this, and it comes time to show the brass. And so General Bradley is there, and General Theodore Roosevelt is there. And so they offload the trucks, and the trucks immediately sink. and the guys pop out of the trucks, you know, and swim to shore. It turns out that they had not realized that there was a drop-off of 20 feet at that section of the beach.
Oh, geez.
And so Barr is just stunned, and Bradley looks at him and says, "Thank you, Major Barr, that was very interesting," and walked away. And Barr took a lesson from this that people make mistakes, and you shouldn't get bent out of shape about it.
I love it. Great. Well, again, Professor Vandermeer, thank you so much for spending some time with us, and we look forward to hearing our listeners' reviews of the book and what they think about Majority Leader Barr and maybe some applications of his leadership on what's happening at the Capitol today. So thank you so much for joining us.